children of Palestine are fighting for our lives. They say to their parents, we know that Palestine is our right. They say to their parents, we'll fight for what is right. They say not to worry, God is on our side. They say we'll die for Palestine. Palestine, forever Palestine.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, no sleep. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Trader with me, Sister Zainab. And so now the title is actually referring to, obviously it isn't getting no sleep, but it's getting no sleep during the night for a particular reason. And I'll just refer to one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense to sort of exemplify this. So this is about Ibrahim Hadi. So it said that, for example, when he had some of his friends come over to his family house, they would literally stay awake all night. Now, and this is not staying awake all night the way, you know, maybe some friends do. They stay awake all night. And nowadays in our sort of modern societies, kids are sort of teenagers or people even in their 20s and maybe even 30s, I think I know some, will stay awake playing, you know, just gaming all night or watching movies all night or literally just sitting and chatting and whatever, consuming their snack food all night, just having a catch-up. But no, when Ibrahim Hadi had his friends come over and they were staying awake all night, what they would do was they would read the Quran and pray all night. And obviously this is... So I wonder whether this is a habit that many of us have to actually do this. And obviously, we can do this on our own. And for sure, it's not that difficult to sort of just devote some extra time, even if it's not. Obviously, it can't be every night because, you know, we have jobs to go to. We have unis to go to, school to go to, other duties in the family. But and obviously on Qadr night, the Qadr nights, this is when obviously we do stay up all night and we read the Quran, we pray and we make lots of dua. But for sure we can do this other times during the year, and it's extremely beneficial to actually just have that, devote that time in a sense to sort of strengthen, re-energize our connection with Allah. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Trader with me, Sister Zainab. And so I'm talking about this idea that we can stay awake all night in worship, we can make dua, and maybe it's also just, this should also just serve as a reminder to, now I'm aware that, I don't know whether it's many or some people obviously do the night prayer. And this is something that's hugely beneficial. And even if, for example, you're not a person who manages to do the night prayer every night, or not even very often, but even if it occurs to you once or a few times, or if you're up super early, if you're staying up late, maybe you've got work or study to do, well, just go and also do a night prayer. So this is obviously things that we do on our own, but this idea that, you know, we can get together with family, with friends, just the way we do on Qadr nights, traditionally anyway, but actually do this maybe some other times to actually just have some time during the night, you know, that nice quiet time where we can actually together read Quran or even pray. And I would even add in there what could even be beneficial is to engage in some sort of deeper conversations, because obviously of many other topics and concepts in Islam. So it might be really useful to then also just have these deeper conversations with our family and friends, where we're really exploring some of the deeper topics, such as the idea, well, what is, you know, the idea that, for example, we ask for guidance from Allah every day. So why do we do that? Why is it so necessary? So in a sense of giving each other a little bit of sort of Islamic education when we can get together, when we have these occasions, rather than just talking about, you know, the latest movies or, you know, something we bought or something that's happening that is a bit more superficial. So may, inshallah, we can sort of bring a bit more depth to some of our conversations too. So I pray that's just a reminder and a little bit of an impetus for all of us. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We start this hour's lineup with leader's speech. The program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Then it's time for a spotlight. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion. And our final program this hour is our varied radio productions feature.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. The Islamic Revolution stood up against the U.S. The U.S. weren't willing to easily give up. Therefore, the plots began. From the very beginning of the revolution, the United States began its provocations against the Iranian nation. They were against the Iranian nation. They weren't just against the Islamic Republic. They were against the Iranian nation. The U.S. started by severing relations. The severance of ties was first started by the U.S. Then it started imposing sanctions, which were followed by various other actions one after another. Truly, anyone who knows, who remembers and doesn't forget what the US has done over the years, realizes the truth of Imam Khomeini's statement, "Let out all your shouts on the US." The US's enmity toward Iran wasn't just a verbal enmity. It wasn't just a matter of sanctions. Their enmity was shown with their actions. The US conspired against the Islamic Republic as much as they could and as far as they could. They helped the inherent enemies of the Islamic Republic as much as they could, and they harmed the interests of the Iranian nation wherever they were able to inflict damage.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The arrogant nature of the US wasn't compatible with the independence-seeking nature of the revolution. This is what I want to emphasize. The conflict between the Islamic Republic and the US isn't a difference in tactics. It isn't an incidental disagreement. It's an inherent difference. If they have the chance, the US will shoot down an Iranian passenger plane with 300 passengers to fall into the sea. If they have the chance, they will compel someone like Saddam Hussein to attack Iran and will provide him with all kinds of support. If they have the chance, they will launch a direct attack on the country. If they have the chance, they will carry out all sorts of activities using propaganda against the Islamic Republic. If they have the chance, they will do anything they can. This is the state of affairs concerning confrontation and the encounter between the Islamic Republic and the US. Some people distort history when writing it.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight on Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Israeli genocide on Gaza continues, along with its frequent attacks on Lebanon, killing more civilians. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has released a document regarding its national security strategy. It says that conflict and violence in the Middle East are subsiding since the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S.'s attack on Iran. Now, the Trump administration says it will now concentrate on the Western Hemisphere and regional dominance. This is, Trump says, the U.S. will re-implement the Monroe Doctrine. Well, what is going on in Trumpville, and where is it all headed, and what does it mean for Latin America and beyond? Stay with us as we take a look at the latest on the Spotlight. Let's begin with this report.
The Trump administration has released its National Security Strategy for 2025, a document that marks stark differences from earlier strategies issued by the same administration. Let's go over some of the key details.
Western hemispheric dominance, aiming to block what it calls foreign influence in the Americas and shift U.S. military assets toward the Western Hemisphere, away from theaters whose relative importance to American national security has declined in recent decades.
The strategy outlines a major shift in U.S. military posture. Observers say the move may be linked to recent U.S. strikes on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and efforts to remove Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro by force.
Deterring conflict over Taiwan, unlike earlier strategies that framed China as the top geopolitical rival, the 2025 NSS declares that economic relations are the decisive arena. It underscores the need for allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific.
The document signals a change in tone. Rather than framing China solely as a geopolitical rival, it emphasizes economic competition as the decisive arena. At the same time, it calls on allies, particularly India, to increase defense spending to help balance China's growing influence in the Indo-Pacific.
Berating Europe, criticizing Europe's migration policies, regulatory focus, and handling of Ukraine conflict, suggesting that the continent must take primary responsibility for its own defense. Switching focus from the West Asia, declaring the region no longer a top priority due to U.S. energy independence and perceived decline in conflict, though still committed to Israel's security. It goes on to argue that the conflict and violence in the region are also subsiding, citing the ceasefire in Gaza and the U.S. attack on Iran in June, which it said significantly degraded Tehran's nuclear program.
It declares the United States energy independent, a claim critics say underscores whether Washington's past involvement in the region was driven by oil. Yet critics point out that Israeli violations of the Gaza ceasefire continue, and Iran remains determined to pursue its peaceful nuclear program. Upon a question about Gaza ceasefire's phase two, Trump told reporters on Thursday that it was going along well. He acknowledged Palestinian deaths as a problem, yet he insisted that West Asia is at peace.
We have peace in the Middle East. People don't realize it. We have tremendous support. 59 countries. There's tremendous support.
Tehran has dismissed the strategy as essentially a security document for Israel. Iran argues that ensuring U.S. access to regional energy resources and guaranteeing Israel's security are the two fundamental issues driving Washington's policy in West Asia. Critics say the new national security strategy only underscores the hypocrisy of the Trump administration, revealing that America's true aim has always been dominating global energy and expanding Israel's power at any cost.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Joe Immisberger, writer and political commentator out of Windsor, Canada. And Mike Billington, author and commentator out of Leesburg, out of the U.S. Thank you both for being with me to start this off in Canada. And Joe, well, let's look at some of the issues highlighted in this document. But first, let me ask you, why now? Why is the U.S. saying that the Western Hemisphere will be its priority and the Middle East or West Asia is actually calming?
Well, it's obviously untrue that it's calming. I mean, the genocide in Gaza continues, and the United States has already forced through a resolution, the UN resolution, making itself the colonial governor of Gaza, of the Palestinian territories, on behalf of Israel. So it's patently untrue that anything's calming. It's just as long as Palestinians are dying at a level that isn't gaining too much attention in media, and as long as Israelis are not dying at a rate that's noticeable in the media, then they consider it to be a calm. So it's obviously untrue. When you look at documents like this, there's obviously a tremendous amount of dishonesty, and so you always have to distinguish between what's real and what's. But the document, to me, I read through it, and it's a typical U.S. Declaration that it rules, that it's the dictator of the entire Western Hemisphere, and that it's going to be determined to be the dictator, basically. So I think some of this shift from West Asia stuff is just appealing to its base that's sick of the so-called forever wars. I mean, they even use that term forever wars in the document. So there's this need to kind of package their or market their foreign policy to their base as something different that's not going to entangle the United States in wars. But when you're seeking to be the world's supremacist state that tells everybody what to do, including your so-called allies in Europe, then of course you're going to a war.
Okay. Well, Mike, I mean, the document says its goal is America first. Of course, that was Trump's main thing running for presidency. I mean, with that in mind, why do we not see a change in Washington's support for the Israeli regime, even with this new document?
Well, with the Israeli machine, the so-called Zionist lobby, this is a deeply ingrained force within the United States. And Trump does respond to that force. He's part of it, in a sense. So that's not surprising. I would emphasize, however, that the big problem, let me say two things. One is that there are very good aspects to this document.
Let's start. Let me
come back to that. The biggest problem with it is this idea that we can take over the Western Hemisphere, and this, of course, is at a moment where the Trump administration, under people like Marco Rubio, we call him Narco Rubio, and Hegseth, are planning to unleash a new war, exactly what Trump swore he would not do during his election campaign and since. But they're about to start a war that would not only be Venezuela, but probably all of Ibero-America. And the real intent here has absolutely nothing to do with drugs, which they claim this is stopping drug trade. But in fact, Venezuela's drug trade is minimal compared to Colombia and other places. But the purpose is to prevent, especially China, but also Russia, from having any role whatsoever in South America. This is what terrifies the financial institutions in London and Washington and New York, which is that the ability to control and loot the raw materials in places like South America, but also Africa and elsewhere, because they're turning to the Belt and Road and to the Chinese for real development rather than just financing and then looting. But let me say that there are very, very positive aspects, and you asked what? Well, I'm going to read you a quote from a former CIA analyst, Larry Johnson, who has become a leading spokesman against the war policy in the U.S. By both the Biden and earlier administrations, and unfortunately, as Trump is not completely separate from, despite his very honorable effort to reestablish relations with Russia, and the work that took place over these last week or so with Wycliffe on his talks with Putin and Ushakov, represent a very positive and potentially resolutionary state of this. And let me read what Larry Johnson said, because he also makes the same mistake on the question of South America, but he says otherwise that this document, marks a potentially profound shift in U.S. foreign policy under President Donald Reagan's second administration, rejecting global hegemony and ideological crusades in favor of pragmatic, transactional realism focused on protecting core national interests, homeland security, and economic prosperity, and regional dominance of the Western Hemisphere. So he capitulates on this so-called dominance of the Western Hemisphere, which, of course, with Rubio and the Trump administration criminally bombing boats for which they have no evidence there's any crimes being carried out. They just claim these are drug boats, but even if they are, they're not in a position to reach the United States. It's a fake. It's like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's a fake excuse for a policy which is very, very dangerous.
Okay, stay with me. Sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but let me get Joe back in on this conversation. I mean, Joe, you heard what Mike had said about the positive sides of this. On the one hand, though, Mike said that, unfortunately, what they're looking at in Latin America and now what they're doing to the fishermen or whatever, this isn't new, though. The policy of the United States, as he also was talking about the WMDs in Iraq, there's always been some type of excuse. But what it seems this document basically also is saying that they're not going to even use the spread of democracy excuse anymore. Because in the document, basically, it's saying that, you know what, people have different ways of running their systems, and basically we're not even worried about that anymore. So there is definitely fundamental change in what is happening. What do you attribute this to, Joe?
Well, the United States has been in relative decline ever since the end of World War II. So to some extent, they have to acknowledge reality. For example, the last Trump's segment of the Republican Party, sure, they're less hawkish towards Russia because they aren't comfortable with the idea of taking on Russia and China at the same time. That's actually stupid from an imperial point of view. So they can look somewhat more rational in a way when they talk about Russia than the Democrats, who are just gung-ho about confronting Russia and China at the same time. So there's kind of an acknowledgement of reality that you're in relative decline and that you have to pick your fights and prioritize. But that's always the case with an empire. But the problem is that when you're an empire, when you're seeking the kind of even regional dominance that they claim they're seeking, it's a global dominance that they're after. But to even do that, they cannot never let any piece of it break away. I mean, that's why Trump's blatantly interfering in the election in Honduras. I mean, is Honduras, unlike Venezuela, doesn't claim to have the world's largest oil reserves or anything, but they can't help but interfere in the small countries like Cuba, even Haiti. They can't let any little piece of the world get away without them being involved and trying to steer it in their direction and undermine its sovereignty. So it's, I think, regardless of even if they sincerely wanted to try to pick their battles, but when you're aspiring to be to dominate the world, then you're going to end up getting intervening everywhere because you just can't afford to let anything slip out of your grasp. So I think this is just a difference in the way different factions of the U.S. ruling elite, the way they market themselves. Trump doesn't want to. His base doesn't like things like, you know, democracy and pretending that they're going to overthrow Maduro out of some benevolent or altruistic desire to free Venezuelans. They prefer to concoct an excuse that we're defending ourselves. So it's a difference in marketing, but the overall global imperial strategy is the same.
All right. Well, Mike, now the U.S. claims that the situation is calming in the Middle East or Western Asia, but in reality, with Washington's continued support of the Zionist regime, the genocide has not ended in Gaza, and the regime continues to kill people in the West Bank and in Lebanon. The U.S. lights the flame and then says it has stepped out of the fire. I mean, what are your thoughts overall about this? Is this just the U.S. knowing that it has failed in West Asia and is trying to find an escape, or How do you see it?
I think both what you and your friend from Canada said is giving into an extremely simplistic view of the world situation as a whole right now. And I don't disagree with what you're saying and what both of you are saying about what's happening in the Middle East and in South America. But the crucial thing taking place in the world right now is that the potential of a global nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, or Russia and China, is being given an alternative approach by what Trump is doing in the total opposite approach of what we've had in previous governments, to try to bring about some cooperation with Russia. And the Russians are very open to this. And he's now going to go meet with Xi Jinping in China. So the potential of having a similar positive relationship with China is also on the table. And nothing can be more important in a world facing economic disintegration and the potential of nuclear war than these three major powers coming together. If we can bring about a sane approach in the U.S. to working with the BRICS countries, working with Russia and with China and the other global South countries, this would be a potential dramatic shift in history. The ending of the colonial era and the unleashing of what could and must be what the LaRouche movement has always fought for, a new architecture based on security and development for every country on Earth. Now, obviously, that doesn't cohere with launching a new insane war in South America, or the continuation of the battle in Gaza and in the Palestinian area.
Let me just jump in here, because isn't that where the problem lies? Understand what you're saying, Mike, as far as perhaps intention in some cases with the U.S. government. But Joe, when we look at the reality that's happening, at the end of the day, the United States is basically the military-industrial complex runs the show, and are they ready to actually give up this hegemonic perspective in creating chaos in order to work together? Yes, we all know that it's better to work together, but that has never been the intent of imperialist entities. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, first of all, the domination of the Western Hemisphere, that makes sense. If you want to confront China and Russia down the road more effectively, you want to secure greater control of the countries closer to you. So what I see this is to some extent some maneuvering to maybe try to get Russia and China basically to sell out South America, Central and South America, and just say, okay, this is our turf. We'll stay out of it, and we'll give you some concessions on other things. So I see that. I see that ultimately is a very sinister maneuver that I don't think is going to prevent the United States from confronting Russia and China, because the very nature of the United States, and you can see it all over this document, is to become the global, become what even more of what it already is, a global empire, a bully that just tells everybody else, including even the Europeans. I mean, it's actually kind of comical in portions of this document where they're demanding, basically shaking down the Europeans for more, and the Canadians for increased military spending. That means, you know, increased money for the U.S. Contractors and stuff. It's just a shakedown. So I think that's in the nature of what the imperial power is. And I think this shift towards the Western Hemisphere is just them positioning for themselves for confrontation, more direct confrontation with China and Russia down the road.
Hmm. Well, Mike, what does it mean in your perspective when Washington says it basically wants to reenact the Monroe Doctrine? First of all, what does it mean for Latin America itself? And also, what does it mean for the Europeans? Because there seems to be a definitely clash there. From the perspective of the Trump administration towards the Europeans?
Well, the Europeans are totally freaked out by this national security strategy, precisely because of what I said before, which is that this strategy very explicitly says Europe is destroying itself he doesn't use the word insane, but he's actually demonstrating a insanity in the leadership of the so-called coalition of the willing in Europe, who are hell-bent on continuing the war with Russia. And they even stupidly claim that they could fight the war themselves without the U.S. military backing, and could, in fact, start a war with Russia, which would be lead rapidly to global nuclear war, and is a level of insanity which has to be identified. So that's the Europeans. In terms of the Monroe Doctrine, I think it's very important to acknowledge that the original Monroe Doctrine was an anti-colonial, anti-imperial policy. It was not to justify U.S. colonial policy in South America. It was to prevent the then colonial powers in Europe from coming into South America. That, unfortunately, was reversed by what was called the Roosevelt Corollary, referring to Teddy Roosevelt, not FDR, who basically said that, in fact, the U.S. will be militarily involved in South America, and subsequently, as we know, they were. But the original was not that intention. The founding fathers of the United States were not only committed to developing America as a strong industrial democratic power, but were absolutely committed to ending colonial power globally. And they were not able to do that because of changes that took place in the United States and then the ultimate emergence of outright fascism in places in Europe and in Asia. So this is a crisis, but the reality of what's taking place with this national security strategy is hopefully, and this is the way our organization and our associates, should be treating this. We can act to prevent the insanity of a new war in South America. We can stop that. It hasn't happened yet. And we can do that by emphasizing the tremendous positive potential of a U.S.-Russia-Chinese cooperation around development. What should they cooperate on? They should cooperate on developing the Arctic, on developing Africa, on developing Ibero-America. Look what's happened in South America so far. China built the biggest port on the entire Pacific coast, the Chiangkai port in Peru, and they're talking to Brazil and others about building a bioceanic railroad between the Pacific and the Atlantic, from the Chiangkai port in Peru up to the Atlantic coast in Brazil. Now, these are the kind of policies that the U.S., with sane leadership, would jump at. It would be tremendous to rebuild the U.S. industrial infrastructure, which is in a state of collapse, not quite as bad as that of Europe, but it's heading in that direction with a financial bubble, with the IT bubble and with the cryptocurrency bubbles, which are now ready to blow apart, bringing about a bigger crisis than the 2008 okay. breakdown. Okay. So, you know, these are issues that should be on our table rather than trying to further exemplify that the U.S. cannot be changed and that it's going to go into another round of wars.
What about that, Joe? I mean, I think probably all of us would agree here that that should be on the agenda of the United States, countries working together. I mean, it really works. But that has not been what we have seen from the United States. And now Trump is criticizing, actually, the Europeans and even their crackdown on free speech and political opposition, while at the same time there is crackdown on free speech inside of the United States. So there just seems to be a lot of contradictions in general. I mean, your take on that part of it.
Yeah, well, when people like Trump talk about free speech, they talk about freedom for Nazis to incite violence against minorities. That's what matters to them. They want you to be able to go out on cameras and say that the immigrants are destroying our country, basically incite violence against ethnic minorities. They're not going to stick up for the Palestine Action Free. That's when people are getting arrested in the UK and being called terrorists because they're opposed to genocide in Gaza. They're never going to stick up for that. That's not free speech that they care or give a damn about. They just care about the fascists being able to incite against ethnic minorities. So that's all this nonsense about free speech that he mentions in in the document. And yeah, I noticed that. The United States, from its founding fathers, has been a genocidal state. I mean, its foundation was based on genociding. It's writing in the Declaration of Independence that the foreign powers were inciting the original inhabitants, the natives of the United States, against them. So it's always been genocidal from day one. I reject this idea that the founding fathers were some noble figures. I mean, that's just a complete reversal of the truth. So in terms of United States trying to get China and Russia to cooperate, I think this is something dangerous because we've already seen what kind of cooperation they could get. For example, the China and Russia both abstained on what was basically a genocidal resolution that allowed the United States and Israel to become the with the UN endorsement, become the colonial rulers of Gaza. I mean, and that's just outrageous. So that's the kind of the rest of the world should be opposed to that. If they're going to be cooperating with the United States to help them suppress countries all over the world, then that's something we should.
All right, let me give Mike 30 seconds. Mike, go ahead. Last comments.
Well, again, you know, these simplistic views which try to create a single view of the direction of what's taking place, rather than thinking like a creative human being about what should we push forward as the necessary positive solution. And again, I mean, we have the potential for a U.S.-Russia-China cooperation, joining the BRICS. Why not have everyone recognize that this is a real potential, and that Trump and some of the better people around him, rather than the Rubios and the Hegseths, recognize that.
I'm out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me, Joe Imsberger out of Canada, Mike Billington out of the U.S. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
A shining jewel right in the heart of the country. It's an enchanting and beautiful city with an ancient civilization. It's a destination filled with wonders.
Kashan runs along the edge of the Great Desert, a four-hour drive that's 250 kilometers southeast of Tehran. The city is a delightful and amazing destination that has managed to preserve its traditional architecture and urban design. Excavations have revealed that Kashan was one of the primary centers of civilization in the prehistoric ages. The first destination that lures you in once you reach Kashan is the impressive Fin Garden.
The Fin Garden is a cultural and historical site located right in the heart of Kashan. The sound of the water among the birds and the trees, as well as all the important events that have taken place in this garden, make this site a popular and beautiful must-see destination.
Covering an area of more than 2 hectares, this garden was built back in the Safavid era in the 16th century. The garden contains numerous cypress trees and combines architectural features of the Safavid, Zandia, and Qajar periods. Kashan is mostly known for its gorgeous and one-of-a-kind architecture. The city showcases some of the best traditional architectural sites in the country. The traditional houses scattered around the city of Kashan are an epitome of grandeur, elegance, and splendor, a direct result of thousands of years of adaptation to the dry desert summers. Efficient yet technical houses that reflect the craftsmanship of the architects of the time.
Kashan is a very beautiful city. I like the architecture and people so.
Architects used bricks for the construction of the main structure, while mud and straw were used for insulation and the facade. Artistic designs like mirror work were used for making the inner spaces, especially the ceilings, look more beautiful. Wind catchers, cellars, and basements were also constructed to make sure there are areas inside the building with cool and pleasant temperature during very hot summer days. During the recent years, these historic houses have been revived, restored, and converted into hotels, residential, and cultural complexes for those who visit Kashan every year. The Omeri House was one of those historic sites that caught our attention. The house was hosting the French Cultural Week, meaning to bring both countries closer in the field of arts and culture. We took a look around, marveling at the splendid architecture and at the same time enjoying the presence of the French and Iranian artists.
Spoon to eat soups. You have a nice soups, vegetable soup, meat, fruit, and you have a beautiful plate to eat in Iran, like carapacha.
So this is my first time in Kashan. I already went in Fin Garden. This is a lovely place. It looks like paradise. I love flowers, tree, fountain water. Here in Kashan, people are so nice, so lovely. And the food is also very delicious.
The Omeri House was built during the Zand era in the 18th century for the governor of Kashan.
Omeri is a real
nice place, and you feel really calm, relaxed. The most important for me is people. They are so kindly. They are so respectable.
Just imagine living in a beautiful grand house like this one. 85 rooms, several courtyards in 9,000 square meters of space. It really does sound like a fairy tale, doesn't it?
The house is beautifully decorated with the smallest of details. The gorgeous mirror works, the delicately carved plaster works on the walls and ceilings, the colorful windows that draw the warm winter light in. Everything about this place is timeless and captivating. Some things can't be expressed in words. Things like love, honor, culture, art, peace, and everything that binds us together as humans, despite our race and the language we speak. Kashan is where the heart speaks. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Life has been a journey where faith is where I roam. But steps I used to walk in don't really match mine no more. I live south for the river where children are quick to grow. Walking down a street full of distraction for some they call it home. So take me home.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. By the way, you're listening to Iran Radio. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. We'll start this hour's program with a viewpoint. The program offers an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of Islamic world today. And we round up this hour's program.